there's 26 people who sit in the House of Lords who dress differently than all the other lords. They're called bishops, and they're actually Lord Bishops. That's a theocratic provision in the English Constitution and in the British Constitution.
We call those life goals.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We're recording this episode on Thursday, August 7th, 2025. I'm Nick Landon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with J.D. Koch, very, very soon to be of Holy Trinity Anglican Church in Hillsdale, Michigan. Matt Kennedy is, as he describes it, at some diocesan preaching thing, so hopefully they straighten him out. We are honored today to be joined by a special guest, Dr. Miles Smith. Guys, how are you doing today?
Great, Nick.
Great.
So Dr. Smith is an assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College. Having received his PhD from Texas Christian University, he researches the U.S. South, the Atlantic world. He writes on intellectual history, ideas, religion, slavery, and freedom, etc., but occasionally dabbles in political history, too. You can find his work in popular outlets like Near Orthodoxy, the Gospel Coalition, Public Discourse, The Federalist, and more. And of course, there's more he's working on, too. I had to summarize his giant bio. Miles, welcome to Stand Firm.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So we've talked on Stand Firm about Christian nationalism a couple times, notably a couple years ago when Stephen Wolf's case for Christian nationalism came out and the conversation seemed to reach a boiling point. We talked a bit about it on episode 192. I looked that up when that Politico correspondent went on MSNBC and said that Christian nationalists, unlike other Christians, are people who believe their rights come from God and not from the government.
I remember that one. I thought the very first one, I mean, basically, as soon as they started telling us we had to wear masks, we started talking about this question.
In a way, we've always been talking about it. You've always been here, Jack. But now the topic is back in the news with the PCA convening a Christian Nationalism Study Committee. Miles, you've written about Christians and governments. I especially loved your article a few years ago about national flags in churches. You're just the person to help our listener get his or her head around this idea. So I hate to start off like this, but I sort of feel like I have to. What is Christian nationalism?
So I think that for so many people, there's so many definitions.
Yeah.
In our context, a sort of, I'll call it a sturdier high church or sacramental Protestant context, I think the definition that is probably most useful is the one from Stephen Wolf.
So
in this sense, I mean, there's a lot of like Pentecostals.
We're going to get flagged now. YouTube's going to flag.
Well, Pentecostals use this term very differently than we do. And they understand Christian nationalism to be actually something that looks more like theocracy. So like the church taking over government. That's not what Stephen Wolf is proposing. He doesn't want the church to take over government. In fact, he wants the church to stay out of government. And he wants a Christian prince to do the job of governing the state. And so for him, there's actually a different moral economy for this Christian prince than there is for church. And so when church tries to do the job of running government, he messes it up. So Wolf is, in this sense, actually a relatively committed to kingdoms guy. And so that's useful, I think, because theocracy and Christian nationalism are actually an antithesis. They're not the same things. They're actually antithetical. So what does theocracy propose? Well, our tradition, the Anglican one, is a bit more theocratic, meaning the church actually did govern and still does govern in certain Anglican countries. There's 26 people who sit in the House of Lords who dress differently than all the other lords. They're called bishops, and they're actually Lord Bishops. That's a theocratic provision in the English Constitution and in the British Constitution.
We call those life goals.
And so that's different than Christian nationalism. I don't think that Stephen Wolf would want any ordained people serving as sort of lifetime, have sinecures in government. So they're two very different things. And I think that at least our friends in the PCA, what they're having to work out is the fact that their tradition is somewhat confused on this. they're not sure which side they're on. They're not sure if they like theocracy or if they like Christian nationalism, because of course there's a wing of the Presbyterian Church. I grew up Presbyterian, and so I can talk about their insider baseball a little bit. There's a wing of the Presbyterian Church that's deeply devoted to the idea of two kingdoms, right? Strict separation. You don't want churchly government at all. There's another side of the Reformed, and I think you can include neo-Calvinist in this, where they may not want a state church, but they want churchly influence in government. They sort of see the church as the heart of the polis. Guys like Pete Lightheart, who I like very much, my friend James Woods, have proposed the idea of ecclesiocentric post-liberalism,
And Woods is
meaning the
on
polis.
this committee.
Yeah, and James Woods is on this committee. A very good pick. Kevin DeYoung, I think, did a great job, picking the committee for the Presbyterian Communion there. But I mean, so the question is, the question really seems to be, at its heart, do people think that the church is a sacramental polis or sacramental imperium, some Anglicans have said, that exists alongside a naturally ordered one? Or is the church some sort of spiritual sacramental agent that serves a naturally ordered polis? And so this is actually the question I think that really gets down to it when someone's asking if they're a theocrat or a Christian nationalist.
Well, now, to be fair, you've laid out two options with which both, at least coming from your lips, sound pretty good and not evil and scary and terrifying.
Right.
What are people who are just scared by the phrase, what are they thinking?
I mean, they're thinking, I assume,
Spanish Inquisition?
the Spanish Inquisition, which is not Christian nationalism. That was a theocratic intervention, of course. That's the church stepping in and then telling the state to do something. So I assume what they're thinking is that this is post-liberal. It's a return to a less tolerant society. It means that not everybody's rights are going to be honored, and that typically maybe the rights of Roman Catholics and Jews will be prescribed. Of course, if you're if you're a Roman Catholic integralist, it means that the rights of Protestants and Jews will be prescribed.
Right.
So I think that
We're not going
that's
to be able to experience the blessings of liberty. That's really the real fear. The real
yeah
fear is
no
that,
I think that that's right. That what you just hit the nail on the head, JD. Like, the fear is that, wait, we have this perfect, or if not perfect, more or less perfect sort of Jeffersonian order that we've been able to experience, and that Christian nationalism will overturn it. And so I think that's the fear, that we're going to return to a history of benighted oppression, and that we'll fall into kind of a second near medieval darkness.
yeah, that's. I think that's. It seems to be the fear, whether articulated explicitly or not. But I think as you're talking, and I'm trying to get my head around these various concepts as well. But it seems to be one of the fears, if you're looking from a Protestant perspective, is for the for taking the priesthood of all believers. It's for the believer in the public sphere who happens to be a civil magistrate in some capacity, a mayor or a town councilman or whatever, actually legislating from his or her Christian convictions as a civil servant. That wasn't really a big problem as long as there was a general consensus around a broadly Christian understanding of broad brush morality. But I think in this modern post-liberal world, we find ourselves up at the edges of that consensus, and that's where the friction lies. It's when you really get to questions of beginning the end of life issues, marriage. These have been the focal points where, when you had a general Christian consensus, broadly speaking, then it didn't really matter what the Christian prince held with respect to Taros, really. I mean, they might disagree on what economists came in, but we're finding the edges here, and I think there's going to be flashpoints that Christian people are going to find, whether they're ordained or not. Whether they're because if you're a Christian head of a medical ethics board and you're a Christian, you're going to find yourself embroiled in controversy if you're a Christian and have Christian convictions, whether you like it or not. Call it Christian nationalism, call it theocracy, call it Seven Kingdoms, dominionism, whatever, it's still going to put you in the crosshairs, and I think people need to be ready for that. I mean, that's how I see it, but I could be missing something.
No, I think that's right. I think one of the things that I saw some interesting statistics on religious affiliation, and I think it's interesting that questions over something like Christian nationalism or theocracy, or just a general religious reaction to the quote unquote post-liberal order, it's happening about the same time that the religious nuns are bottoming out or topping
Interesting.
out. So what I think that what you're seeing is there was a thought really in the last decade or so that, eventually Christians would go the way that they did in Europe, that they would have these tiny, I mean, small minorities, 15% and less of a given country's population, and that their political power would be prescribed. And so you would essentially have what you have in the Scandinavian countries or in Germany, conservative Christians being treated sort of like, second, third rate citizens. Well, that didn't happen. So the populations doesn't mean that the number of Christians is going up. Ryan Burge, I think, has done good statistical work on this. The number of Christians isn't going up, but it's not shrinking
Right.
anymore. So you still have to deal with the fact that Christians and some expression of conservative Christians are a really powerful minority, perhaps even a plurality in the United States. And so what people have realized is, oh, we still have the ability to politically organize. And what are the principles we can politically organize around? I think something like Christian nationalism provides a useful principle to politically organize around. So in that sense, I think Christian nationalism, as I understand the proposition, is openly political philosophy and not really trying to be even political theology.
That's right.
And so I think that distinction is important.
I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, "I don't care what the founding fathers thought." I think that that's though a relatively rare sentiment. I think it's more common that people sort of project onto the founding fathers whatever it is they currently want. Are you able to shed some light on the Christian nationalism question and the founding? Obviously, the founding fathers is not a monolith, but what were they thinking about the nation and Christianity?
Just talking about the give today, so don't tell the students. I think one of the things, I'm not even sure what I think about this, because I like Thomas Jefferson. I like the ability to give the middle finger to government. Like I live in Michigan, so every time Her Excellency the Governor of Michigan does something dumb, and like JD get ready for it, turns out
Listen, I can't
having what's funny is the governor of South Carolina is a ruling elder in the Associated Reformed Presbyterian Church, which is technically an establishmentarian Presbyterian denomination. So you're
And
going from,
he's done a great job. Well, there's so many of the things that I was happy to live in South Carolina during COVID, I can assure you
so you're
that.
going from the Christian Prince Henry McMaster
That's right.
to Her Excellency the
Dorito communion Doritos, right?
And so I like Jefferson. I like all that stuff. But I think I've come around to a realization that the founding is not this kind of Jeffersonian liberal democratic proposition, that it's holding a lot more of what you might think of as historically English political theology with what you might call Christian nationalism or theocratic, kind of whichever way you want to look at it, propositions built into the United States. And the talk I'm going to give today is especially that plays into not just how they govern, but how they fight, how the military is organized. So my colleague Khalil Habib, who's a devout Maronite Catholic, made a good observation yesterday, and was just talking to the students here. He said, Jefferson and Madison are actually kind of outliers in the founding kind of framework. And so I think what we've done is we assume, well, no, they're the norm. Everybody shared their convictions. And that's not, turns out that's not true. And so the United States is not a creation of sort of a novus ordo seclorum where we actualize secular liberalism. It's a relatively conservative Protestant polity that has a different political philosophy in some ways than Great Britain or European countries, but it doesn't mean that political philosophy, as different as it is aimed at a different social and religious telos. Like, no one's trying to create a revolutionary state. They want to
That's right.
preserve essentially what is a relatively healthy Protestant community. And it doesn't mean that that community will be just Protestant in the coming years. And I make this point in my book. Doesn't mean that it will stay just Protestant, but it doesn't mean it will be anything less than Protestant going forward either. And so I think that the founding is relatively capacious. It means you can fit a lot of political philosophies within the founding political philosophies. And certainly a place like Massachusetts or Connecticut, New Hampshire, even South Carolina, to a lesser extent, these states that had pretty robust establishmentarian structures, they are kind of Christian nationalists. Doesn't mean every place was, but certainly doesn't mean it was beyond the pale. New York State is a good example. Of course, you have guys thrown into jail for being disrespectful to the Holy Family in a Protestant state well into the 19th century. So I think that the founding is a big thing. It's not this narrow little thing that's meant to create, 1998 Los Angeles in 1776, right? Like, it's a big thing. And so,
Well, yeah, you had a group of guys who, someone pointed out on Twitter recently when it's part of this discussion about Presbyterians, and there was a, that there was the sort of rigid two kingdoms, and one person was arguing that, that there had been not a quietism, but at the very least a detachment in a certain segment of reform thought from political action, and the rejoinder was, we don't forget that these are the same Presbyterians that executed a monarch, so they're like, just so you know, like, these are the there was a level of conviction. I mean, not, obviously not the actual founders, but like the downstream conviction of the prioritization of divine law, over against all human claimants. There was a when you have that as your foundation, you're going to order your society in a broadly speaking Christian way. I mean, if that's your, Samuel Rutherford, if that's your conviction, you're going to have a similarity, interdenominational similarity, which I think you see in the founding of America, which in my estimation is quite beautiful. I mean, the interreligious plurality, or the interdenominational Christian plurality that is represented by the original colonies, and the relative peace between them is really remarkable. I mean, if you look at Christian history, certainly look at what was happening in parts of Europe, earlier. And I think, to your point, Miles, that the founding, as much as an outlier as Jeff, I mean, of course, I'm no expert in this, but it's from my read, as they the two of them may be, that the combination of their experience and insight produced a type of Christian liberalism that I think, the only objection to it would be if you weren't a believer. I mean, really, because if you were a Catholic, if you were a Puritan, if you were a Quaker, like, whatever, you had a space. Even if you were a Jew, if you were even an unbeliever, for that matter, like, you had a sense of freedom that is beautiful, but it did require a certain, at least, appreciation of a Christian consensus at the foundation. That when we see that removed, we're going to have a much different argument, or the argument's going to be much different, as we see now.
yeah, I think that
But
what
correct me anywhere,
well, no,
correct me, Dr.
I think you're
Miles,
exactly
Dr. Smith.
right. I think that the question for me is, I'm fine if there's sections of the United States that are liberal and democratic and secular, but the proposition I think that's what's come about is that a lot of people think that the American founding was meant to actualize something that looked like France's 1905 secularization
That's right.
law, which wherein secularism is actually the national telos and the state-sanctioned national value.
That's right.
That's never been the case in the United States. And so what that means is, whether Christians like it or not, you're allowed to. Maybe I'm not even a Christian. Maybe I'm some sort of atheist, right? There's no law that privileges me and my intellectual and sort of political telos in the United States over Christians. So here's the good news and the bad news. Especially for For Christians who are interested in these things, this will be good news. And I think for Christians who aren't interested in politics, this will be bad news, because it means that, guess what? The United States is meant to be kind of messy. We're meant to have these battles. We're meant to have sort of almost theocrats and almost communists kind of duke things out. And so, you know, that's how capacious the sort of the founding was. You've got a guy like Thomas Jefferson in the same place as a guy like Timothy Pickering. If you don't know who Timothy Pickering is, he's one of these arch Federalist establishmentarians who kind of basically wanted the United States to look as much like England without actually being England. And so I think the bad news for people who, like me, who maybe don't love the fact that Christians need to be or could be or should be or might be politically active, is there's nothing about the Constitution that prohibits that. And so, you know, my sort of spirituality, the church, Presbyterian upbringing is such that I kind of still flinch at that stuff. I don't really like, you know, people doing politics at church. I don't like political sermons. So my DNA is kind of like, I don't know, that isn't that kind of bad? Well, the fact of the matter is, I have the right to think it's bad and I have the right to not like it, but I don't have the right to tell people that they can't have political Christianity or that they can't practice Christian political philosophy. There's nothing about our Constitution that gives me the right to impose my kind of quietest dispositions on someone else. And there's nothing, at least in the Anglican Church, there's nothing about Anglicanism that allows me to baptize my quietism as our doctrinal or canonical standards. In fact, and this is where I think the conversation is different for Anglicans than it is for the Reformed. We actually are kind of theocratic in our dispositions, right? Our canonical life is more Christian nationalist, theocratic, whatever you want to call it, than Presbyterians in its DNA. And so the conversation for Anglicans is probably less if a country will have religion or not, then what religion the country will have, and how should it be administered? How should it be kind of organized?
Yeah, I mean, I see in the way the Anglican polity has played out, you know, a good separation, a distinction of, I think, what Luther would call the estates, you know, the family, the church, and society, the political realms, you know, and they're interconnected. They're distinct, but they're interconnected in the sense that, like, you know, is often said, everything, not everything that's sinful is illegal, right? Or at least not everything that's sinful should be illegal, or at least be politicized in that respect. And I think you can make much of that distinction intellectually and consider it and be very fruitful, you know, for the Christian magistrate. You know, you can have some deep convictions about what might be sinful, for instance, in your family life. You know, I mean, you as a married man, you know, you should, you know, forsaking all others as long as you both shall live. You know, this is something that you can confess to. Now, should that be prosecuted from the state? You know, that's an interesting question. You know, of course, and it's been answered in the affirmative for many years, and it's you know, in certain places, it wasn't an issue, and so on and so forth. So, I think that from my way of thinking, I do appreciate these distinctions between the realms, the estates, the kingdoms, whatever you want to call them. But I think that for the Christian leader and the Christian person, you know, whether ordained or not, or just consider themselves priesthood of all believers, like we said before, that this genuine iteration or sort of interrelation needs to be deeply considered as we move forward, because there's a goodness to the mercy of God through the church for the sake of the world that has always been present since Abraham was called out of Ur. You know, there would be a blessing to the nations. And then we see that for, you know, from Egypt on down, you know, we see it through wherever the truth of God was revealed through his people. It was for the good of not just them, but for their surrounding cultures and societies. And so, you know, I think we can't lose that conviction as the church, however sort of gently we're going to have to reiterate it and articulate it in a contentious pluralistic society, but that we must hold to that conviction, in my opinion, is something that if we lose, we've lost our salt and light witness to the world. And so, for instance, you know, going into societies, that have much different convictions about the nature and dignity of children, for instance, or the sanctity of human life, or just simple things like theft and private property. You know, these are things that are enshrined in our conviction about who God is and what he's revealed to the world, and call it what you want. But if we lose conviction about the goodness of that for the sake of our neighbor, then we forfeited one of the greatest, the two commandments, to love God and love our neighbor as ourselves. And one of the ways that I, as a Christian prince, would love my neighbor is to lovingly enshrine in the legal code something that would allow for human dignity, human flourishing, and a right ordering of society. Now, call me a Christian nationalist, call me a whatever you want, but that's what I believe. And I believe it first in my family. You know, you preach it, you think it's a fruit of the work of the church, which is preaching the gospel, not necessarily setting forth a legal framework. But then, as a Christian person is nurtured through the church in the context of a Christian family, in the work of their civil governance, this is how that sort of fugue, you know, of God's mercy will play itself out in society. And we have history to look back on and see where it's gone well and where it's gone wrong. But we're the conflict we're at now is that there's an increasingly shrill, I don't know how prolific it is or how large, but the shrill voice is reacting to any appeal, as Nick, you mentioned that the previous episode we did, to a Christian conviction about public order. And we're going to have to lovingly absorb that in for the good of the polis, in my opinion. And Christian people need to be prepared to defend their convictions, not from a theocratic, you know, authoritarian place, but from a genuine place of care and concern for neighbor. And I think, you know, that's just something that we're all attempting to do, at least I hope. And we're grateful for people like you and the work that you're doing, the heavy lifting and the actual footnoting and all of the archive, you know, digging to help, you know, equip and strengthen us in this increasingly important conviction that I think Christians are going to have to, well, they're being confronted with whether they like it or not, and they're going to have to be able to articulate the hope that they have in the face of opposition. And well, and that's just going to be our walk over the next years and perhaps decades.
I think just this is anecdotal, but I think it's worth bearing out. A lot of the fear of Christian nationalism, theocracy, whatnot, comes from boomers. There's a sort of an age, gap here. And I don't want to make fun of some of their fears, but I think that a lot of what we're seeing is just not so much even religious objections, but a particular philosophy of history. And that philosophy of history is wedded to the idea that there was some sort of final form of human government that was created in the aftermath of World War II and that history sort of stopped. And I think Francis Fukuyama,
No, Fukuyama, that's right.
it's kind of
End of history. That's
end
right.
of history. In fairness to Fukuyama, he said, but history might come back right after he said we've reached the end of history. So I don't, it's not really Fran's fault that he's been misinterpreted. But nonetheless, I think that this is in the ether. All right, people born in the middle of the 20th century really thought that history had ended. And they're terrified about history not ending because it means a return for them. I think you see this in the writing of someone like Robert Kagan. It means to them a return to everything that was benighted about the past. And I should say, I like the post-war liberal order. I think it's been awesome. I grew up in the Sun Belt in the 90s and the aughts, and it was really cool.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to keep the best of that. But I also think the best of that was heavily informed by Christianity.
Amen.
So if I get to the point where someone asks me, puts a gun in my head to choose between the post-war order and public expressions of Christianity, I hope I would have the guts to choose Christianity. I don't know if I would sometimes. I don't know if I would, because if does that mean like being in a world dominated by Southern Baptists who boycott Disney? Well, I like some Disney stuff. Like that's kind of cool. And so I think the lazy part of me is like, yeah, it's kind of dumb, all the boycotts. Who cares about, XXX on TV? But it's still my Christian calling is such that it might be that I have to actually live with those people. This is something I didn't come out, I went to a public college. I didn't live in really Christian, conservative Christian spaces for much of my 20s, and I liked it. I liked the big secular liberal world. Even when I was a Christian, I thought it was great. Like homeschooling and homesteading is not my reflex at all. I think it's kind of weird. And yet, I think I want to do better than maybe the boomers did, who basically have decided, well, those people are so weird, we want to get rid of them. I think maybe it's my Christian calling to be uncomfortable in a world I don't understand. And that open-handedness is hard. I can tell you, I lived in cities my whole life. I live in a town of 7,500 people in Michigan. I wasn't homeschooled. I have one sibling. And so I live in a world that's very different than the one I grew up in. But I don't want to get to the point where, even if I'm uncomfortable, and Lord knows I am a lot of times, I don't want to get to the point where I've decided that my way is some sort of special sacred way, and that this other stuff is too weird to be actually the kingdom. I think what I've had to realize is the kingdom is weird, and coming kingdom may make me a little bit uncomfortable, but my Christian calling is not to be comfortable.
Well, wow, I'm resembling that remark. I know you got to go. That someone, as we've spoken about many times, is you told my 22-year-old Liza and I'll be married 22 years this September. If you told us back then that we'd be homeschooling, considering homesteading, moving to a 7,500 person town with seven children, and talking about Christian about the possible benefits of a Christian prince, I wouldn't have believed you, but here we are. So I'm grateful, so grateful for you and your part of this conversation. And look, it won't end with this for sure, but we're grateful to be part of this discussion. And I think that was very poignant to me that the prayer and the hope for all of us is that we will have the courage to follow the Lord, as countercultural as it may not only be from an outside perspective, but even from a from our internal perspective, but that that's there's a goodness to that, and that if we acknowledge that but ask for his conviction and courage, that he'll give it to us. And so that's the hope.
Well, this conversation could and perhaps should go on a lot longer. Miles, though, has taken time out from a conference. He came from one thing and is now off to another. So that's going to have to be all our time today. Thank you for listening to Stand Firm this week. You can keep the conversation going by being in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to JD Koch, and a special thank you to Dr. Miles Smith. Lord willing, Matt Kennedy will be back with us next week. I'm Nick Lannon, and we'll be back, all of us, next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.